May it please the court. Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Mr. Donovan. My name is Jan Van Amerongen. I am the both trial attorney and appellate counsel for Marquise Mason in this case. Marquise Mason was a 16-year-old who, on Halloween night of 2006, found himself in a situation to some extent of his own making, to some extent not of his own making, in which he fired a gun and killed Parrish Johnson. This case was brought as a first-degree murder case by the state of Delaware against Mr. Mason. He was 17 at the time of his trial. At the time that he was interrogated by the police, at the time he was arrested, he was 16. Mr. Mason went to trial in this case, was found not guilty by a jury of murder of first degree, not guilty by the jury of murder in the second degree, and guilty of manslaughter, and also possession of a firearm by a person prohibited, as well as possession of a firearm during commission of a felony. Throughout discovery, the discovery process in this case, the state had provided the defense with various information, typical in a case like this, and it included a DVD containing the recorded interview of Mr. Mason by the police. Mr. Mason was interrogated in the presence of his mother in an interrogation room for quite some time. During the course of that interview, he indicated to the police that he had been on probation. He indicated to the police that he was concerned about a violation of probation because he hadn't been where he was supposed to be on several occasions with respect to that probation. The police were asking him questions. Steadfastly, he denied to the police any involvement in the shooting. He denied specifics, and he denied being there. In fact, when asked where he was that Halloween night, he indicated he couldn't really remember exactly where he was. The police kept at him, kept questioning, kept telling him, consistent with interrogation techniques, that we know where you were. We have witnesses that place you where we know you were. And he continued to deny his involvement. Moving forward to the beginning of this trial, there was jury selection. Following jury selection, the prosecutor for the state advised the trial court that he had some issues that he wished to raise with the court, issues that he was not going to bring in the form of a motion, but just, I believe his term was, as a roadmap for where we're going. So the court recessed for about an hour. We all met in chambers, and the state for the first time indicated its intention to play the statement of Mr. Mason, or the interview of Mr. Mason, in its entirety, including the portions discussing the fact that he was on probation, including the portions that indicated he could be violated for that probation. This is something that, having tried many cases in the Superior Court, was actually a first for me. In the context of drug cases, it comes up quite a lot that there are administrative searches and probation and parole is involved in cases. And the state has always gone to great pains to explain to its officers not to refer to themselves or their brother and sister officers as probation and parole officers, but simply law enforcement officers. Themselves, the prosecutors, make sure not to bring that out during the trial. The theory, of course, is that that could taint or poison a jury against the defendant and deny that defendant a fair trial should the jury learn that the defendant is on probation. That being said, Mr. Wood, for the state, I will confess that I must admire his advocacy in not simply foregoing the possibility of raising my client's probation status. And he found a receptive ear in the trial court, as it turns out, and the trial court permitted him over the defense objection. And in fact, the court asked the defendant to file a motion to preclude any evidence that it wished to strike from that statement, which the defense did.
Let me ask you this question. I'm not sure where you're going with the timing of the state's disclosure of this desire to introduce the tape. There was discovery, correct?
There was.
And in the pretrial discovery, did the defense have a copy of the tape?
We did. We did not have a transcript, but we had the tape, and we had viewed the tape, and we knew that that it contained references to probation.
And there was no motion in limine filed by the defense?
Not by the defense, no, Your Honor, nor by the state.
Okay.
Your Honor, with respect to that, two things. First, with respect to the timing, I raise it because the state in its brief and the judge, the trial court, raised it in chambers when we were discussing the issue, why it had not been raised. Quite frankly, the reason it had not been raised is because I had never had a single case in which the state took that position. They had always taken the position that they would not disclose a defendant's probation status. I did have one case, which
well, that's the reason for your analogy to the reference to probation and parole officers as law enforcement officers.
Correct.
To suggest to us that there was no reason for us to ask the question why you didn't file a motion in limine to prevent it.
Your Honor, quite frankly, I could have, and now I do. Having learned that lesson, I suppose, the hard way, in my opinion, and perhaps I was mistaken, and in this case I certainly was, in that the court expected it of me, the proponent of the evidence, if they believe there's going to be an objection, and if they believe that there is an issue, as Mr. Wood put it, could also file a motion in limine to speed the process along. The proponent of that evidence could have informed me sooner than after jury selection of their intent.
Well, were you prejudiced procedurally because of the way that that happened? Is that part of your argument?
No, Your Honor. Okay. I'm not going to say that.
Is it your, I mean, your position is that it was error on the part of the trial court, presumably of an abuse of discretion.
Correct.
To admit the videotape with that information. Is the argument that the prejudicial effect outweighed the relevance, or was there some other basis for claiming that it was error?
That was the argument, Your Honor, that the substantial prejudice that was at risk there outweighed any relevance. What was argued by the state at the time before Judge Brady was that they were not going to be able to redact this statement sufficiently because the references to probation were in many different pages and many different points during the interview. And the argument made to the trial court was that, in essence, Mr. Mason had opened the door to this problem by himself interjecting in response to their questions that he was on probation. At the time, I argued that certainly a 16-year-old isn't opening the door to something at a trial a year later, as in the sense that it was attempted to be made an analogy to someone on the stand opening the door to something on a further cross.
Well, I understood that it was not just that there were numerous references to probation made by your client, but that the manner in which he kept bringing it up was almost a kind of in-your-face attempt to argue with the interrogator, and that it therefore served a different purpose and was subject to different consideration as to its admissibility or not, because it was kind of a demonstration of what your client's attitude was about the whole interview and the crime.
I do understand as well that that is the argument that has been made in the state's answering brief on this appeal.
But what's wrong with that argument?
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully suggest that what has happened in that interview is that he has repeatedly said he was not involved. He is saying he has nothing to worry about other than a violation of probation. However, what the state is doing is not bringing in an inculpatory statement that is intertwined with him indicating he has probation, is on probation. Rather, they are taking his denials of involvement and, in essence, trying to show the jury that this man, by his attitude and manner, is basically they're trying to inflame the jury about this man because of his attitude and manner, not about the substance of his denials for the crime. Your Honor, certainly the state is entitled to present its case as it believes it can, and the court is entitled to use its discretion with respect to the admission of evidence. However, there was certainly the possibility of redacting this tape. If we look at Mr. Wood's cross-examination of Mr. Mason after Mr. Mason eventually testified.
That's really the question I had. Was it practical to redact all of the references to probation and still have the videotape look like something that was recognizable to a jury?
Yes. In my opinion, yes. We've redacted.
And was that argued to the trial judge?
It was, Your Honor. It was said that we could redact the tape. The transcript was supplied to the judge at the time that she made her decision so that she could go through that. I don't recall specifically if she made reference to that being one of the reasons that she decided not to ask the state or order the state to redact it. However, if we look at the cross-examination conducted by Mr. Wood, he does not rely on any of the portions that were referenced by Mr. Mason indicating that he was on probation. He specifically asks him questions, which he later indicated were either not true or he didn't recall, about other statements that he made to the police. So if this was of such importance to the state, the state could have focused on it more than it did. It simply played it and allowed the prejudice to sit with the jury.
I take it that the reason that the trial judge denied your request to redact the statement, either the transcript, which would have obviously been easy to do, the tape perhaps logistically a little more difficult, the reason must have been that the trial judge thought there was some relevance to the references to probation, much along the lines of what Justice Berger's question suggested. Is that correct or not correct?
I believe that what the court found was that since Mr. Mason brought it up, it was going to be played, and I believe the court found that it was throughout the interview, although throughout might really mean 7 pages out of 30-some pages, I believe.
Well, if Mr. Mason had brought out in his interrogation, now, look, I've been convicted of murder once before, on that theory, would it have come in prior conviction?
I certainly hope not.
Well, what's the difference in the theory? I'm trying to get at, in the balancing test, what was the relevance of the reference to being on probation, given the obvious prejudice of the jury hearing that he was on probation at the time he was accused of committing this crime and at the time he was on trial.
All I can help you with respect to that is the state's argument submitted here in its answering brief.
Well, I'm less interested, frankly, in the state's argument than I am in the ruling that the trial judge made, and I'm trying to get at her rationale in the balancing test for finding the reference to probation relevant at all.
Your Honor, I would like to be able to tell you that I could specifically advise the court what her rationale was. I attached.
Other than the fact that Mr. Mason brought it up in an attempt to deflect, during the course of the interrogation, attention away from him, I guess.
Yes, I don't know if this went into the court's rationale, however, the court did ask me both the first time it was raised and then also when we were arguing after I had submitted the motion and the state had submitted its response. She did ask me again how long I had had the DVD. I don't recall her specifically saying that her ruling was premised in part on my not acting sooner, but the fact that it was raised more than once certainly affected how I was looking at it at the time.
Well, there's no finding that you'd waive the argument or something along those lines, is there?
No, certainly not. She, in fact, told me that I had until 5 p.m. the next day to file the motion, which I took as indication that the court was not going to disregard the motion that I then filed.
Well, following up on the Chief Justice's question, what I'm gathering is that the trial judge ruled, number one, that if there was any prejudice, it was entirely of Mr. Mason's own making. But that, even so, how does that advance the analysis if there was no relevance?
I don't feel that it does. I don't feel that it does. I think the only thing that had been argued was that it was, at least by the state at that point, was that it was going to be difficult to redact. It does not go to a probative nature or relevance of that evidence at all.
In other words, the state wasn't arguing that it was relevant, just that it wasn't prejudicial.
That it was going to eviscerate their ability to play the statement is perhaps one of the words Mr.
Right. And you said, no, it won't, and the trial judge, as far as you know, did not rule on that point?
I can't say. It was a brief. I can say to the court that it was certainly considered by the trial court, the fact that it was throughout, but I don't believe that the ruling was specifically limited to that reason.
Well, if that was the only argument the state made, then one would expect that the trial judge would have ruled on that.
I had hoped that would be the result.
Well, let's assume for the sake of argument that the trial judge abused her discretion. Did it have any effect on the outcome of the trial, given the balance of the evidence?
I think it did, Your Honor. This was a jury that deliberated for an entire day. This was a jury that had had a request for testimony to be read back, and it was read back. This was a jury that acquitted of the two lead charges. So they had four options: murder first, murder second, manslaughter, and acquittal. And what they did is they came to the conclusion that there was manslaughter. Of course, the other issue that I have raised on appeal is that there should have been an instruction as well for negligent homicide, which the state objected to in the court.
Before we go there, and I realize you're running out of time, what effect on the fact that the defendant was on probation did the fact that the defendant was also charged with possessing a weapon while being a person prohibited, which the jury would have known, isn't it a wash under those circumstances?
I would say no, Your Honor, because certainly someone can be prohibited. Not that any reason was given to the jury for the prohibition, but somebody could be prohibited simply by being 16. Somebody should not lawfully have a firearm.
The jury didn't know why he was prohibited?
No. In this case, there was a stipulation that he was simply prohibited on the date in question.
But the indictment itself doesn't have in its statement of the charge of person prohibited why they're prohibited?
It does, but
the jury had the indictment.
Now, the indictment, the jury was read the indictment, but at the time they were read the indictment, the stipulation was read basically to them by the court, indicating that he was prohibited. At the time of the jury instructions at the close of the case, also the indictment with the language about him being prohibited because of a reckless endangering conviction was not read to the jury. So it is my belief that the jury was never advised of the fact that he had a previous conviction.
One more question in terms of the impact, assuming it was an incorrect ruling, whether it was harmless error. Your client admitted that he killed this person, right? But claimed it was self-defense.
He admitted that he killed the person. I claimed certainly that it was self-defense. He acted in justification, I believe, both for his own life.
But the point is that if the jury has to decide, did your client kill another person, there was no question. The answer was yes.
Yes.
And so then the only question is, were there circumstances that would make it less than first-degree murder, less than second-degree murder, potentially not even criminal? So doesn't that suggest that what he may have said on a tape about being on probation would have no impact on the decision?
I don't believe so. I think that The intent of the state, quite frankly, was to have the jury hear that, to have a jury consider that in the back of their mind, despite the fact that they're instructed most likely not to, so that then they would think, well, you know what? He was there. He had a gun. He shouldn't have been there. He's a drug dealer. And he was on probation. Let's convict him. Now, I wasn't in the room. I'm certainly hoping that's not what happened. But the temptation is there, and I think that the reason for interjecting somebody's probation status is quite plain, and that's it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we've talked you right through your rebuttal time, too.
I've had that happen before, Your Honor.
Sorry.
Good morning, if it please the court. Just to begin with, about the timing of the various motions, there was a motion in limine filed by defense counsel on October 26th and answered by the state. There was also reference to an office conference at which many of the redaction issues were worked out. I should point out the statement transcript in the appellate's appendix is totally unredacted. This is the one that came from the police. There were large sections that the jury never saw. For example, a very large chunk from A28 through A39 after the police leave the interrogation room. There's a conversation between the defendant and his mother that was out. The defense also wanted redacted certain portions regarding a stolen car. That was redacted. So the redaction issues were hammered out, except for the one about probation, and that was not decided until trial.
Let me ask what may seem like a silly question, but this is a problem that arises not – it's not an unusual problem to have a statement that includes references to prior crimes or to probation or whatever, that everybody knows from the outset that's going to be an issue and that's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
Why does the state risk their prosecution and their ultimate conviction by pushing to have information that we know from prior cases is inflammatory or prejudicial, and still arguing to the trial court, oh, no, leave that in. I don't understand what the thinking is behind doing that and thereby putting yourself or your prosecution at risk.
In general, in cases like this, and I've dealt with quite a few of them, and I've been before this court in big trouble a number of times, and I'm sure the court's aware of that. We go through, just as the court must do, when we decide, we have to go through our balancing test. Hopefully the prosecutor, before he starts pushing it, has done a good balancing test there and has seen that just the typical 403 type, that, the relevance there outweighs or is not substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. And sometimes, of course, the prosecutor is wrong, and I've been down here defending that kind of problem totally unsuccessfully in the past. In this case, though, and this is where I really take issue with my colleague's position here, that he took a trial and he's taking now, is that somehow our position was, well, the defendant opened the door to his probationary status, and therefore we could rush in. And that was not our position at all. We didn't care whether this guy was on probation or not. Judge Brady was very, very clear in making her decision that she was not basing this on any opening the door. I mean, she said blank out, if the state raised an opening the door argument here and tried to bring in the probation officer or put the criminal record in or something like that, she would nix that right away. The fact of the matter is, the defendant here is using this VOP, which nobody knows whether he actually was on probation or not, but the police certainly didn't. But every time the cops say murder, he says VOP. Every time the cops say murder, he says VOP. He's playing cat and mouse with them. He's taunting them. And our point was that this taunting is what we want the jury to hear. We don't care whether he's on BO, whether he's on probation or not. We don't care whether he violated his probation. The defendant says, you know, every time the cops try to go to murder, he goes, oh, yes, that VOP, yes, yeah, well, they'll probably, you know, I'll probably get 6 months for that VOP. And at one point, the cops actually blow up at him. If you mention VOP one more time, we're walking out of here, right? You're done. Do you understand? We're not here for a VOP. You're here for murder. Do you understand that? You know, I don't think I've ever seen an interrogation where it's the cops who threaten to end it because that's on page A15. So well, certainly he got under their skin. But it was this attitude that he was taking, more than simply a denial on Mr. Mason's part. Mr. Mason is having a good time here. Mr. Mason, now accused.
So if I understand you, the state's position is, okay, this guy kept referring to VOPs and being on probation and so forth, and he was doing it in a way that was intentionally meant to aggravate the police and to be
exactly
objectionable. So because that was what he was doing and he was being a wise guy, if you will, that gave the state a reason to put in all this, you know, the actual statements as part of the evidence. My problem here is that although you may be right, it does demonstrate that the guy was being a wise guy, it also has to do with revealing prior criminal record indirectly, which is kind of as clear-cut as can be, is something that doesn't go in front of the jury. So how do you expect to just ignore what the content of his objectionable comments was? If every time the police asked him a question, he said, you know, you're a jerk, you suck, whatever. You know, if that was his response, then fine, that goes in front of the jury and shows what kind of a person he was. But if his responses have to do with his own criminal background, how do you ignore that and just say, well, we want it in for a different reason?
Well, first of all, this was his way of saying you jerk. But even more than that, I mean, he got to play the total naive here. Oh, yes, right. You know, pretend on the one hand I'm very cooperative, Mr. Police Officer. You know, I will confess to you, yes, I did it. I violated that probation for which I will get 6 months in prison. So it's more than just calling the police officer a jerk. I mean, he gets to pretend that he wants to cooperate. I want to cooperate with you. I want to tell you anything you want to know about my VOP. But every time you mention murder, I'm just going to say, no, that has nothing to do with it. No, it's the VOP. That's what I'm going to confess to you. I'm a totally honest person. You know, I made a mistake. I violated my probation, and I know I'm going to get 6 months in jail. I know, or Ferris, or wherever. I don't even know if it's a juvenile probation or not. So it was all of this. I mean, it's more than just name calling. It's more than just name calling. It was a very interesting young fellow.
The
other side, the 403, was there substantial unfair prejudice? Well, the defendant himself said what he's going to get for it.
Mr. Donovan, what does the statement about the VOP, even under the circumstances you've described, what relevant evidence does it produce for the purpose of whether or not he shot with whatever mens rea at the time he shot the victim in this case? What's the real relevance for any fact the jury has to find in order to convict?
Well, this, again, I think goes to his entire attitude here, which goes beyond a simple denial, is that he is very cavalier about this. Here he is faced with a first-degree murder charge, and he can be so cold-blooded in the way he's interacting with the police, that one could believe, yes, this is the type of person who could indeed just fire a point blank range twice and would go towards, eventually, Well, certainly the whole statement goes to impugn his credibility and counteract his self-defense defense, but also the type of person who comes through in this statement, this rather cold-hearted, very, very calm, collected character.
So is it a credibility issue?
I'm sorry?
Are you suggesting that it's a credibility issue?
But eventually it's going to be a credibility issue, yes, because he's going to take the stand. Now, this was the state's case in chief. However, we did have a witness, an inmate by the name of Kevin Wynn, to whom the defendant said, yes, I admit it, I shot Johnson, but it was self-defense. I thought he was going to shoot me first.
So if I understand your answer to the Chief Justice's question correctly, the references to probation were not relevant in the the academic analytical sense. They were relevant as demeanor evidence. Is that right?
As to showing what kind of person this was. No, whether or not he was on probation, I mean, we didn't care about that. And in our closing argument, I don't think Mr. Wood ever mentioned the fact that he said he was on probation. He said he was there taunting the police. And I think that's important. That's important for the jury to know. The statement is more than a simple denial. He didn't go in there and say, no, I didn't do it. No, he went around. No, he had the presence of mind when faced with this serious accusation.
Just one other thing to clear up for me on that.
Yeah.
If he had said in his taunting mode, as you've described, oh, you want to talk about my prior, he probably wouldn't have used the word prior, only lawyers do that, but my earlier conviction for burglary, rather than to say that I'm on probation, would your position be the same?
Now, that raises more of a problem that the judge was going to have to, or we would. But I think in a situation like that, where now we have a specific crime mentioned, as we don't hear. We have no idea what he's talking about, except it's relatively minor because he says.
Yeah, and I picked a crime that would impugn someone's credibility.
I'm sorry?
I picked a crime as an example that would go to his credibility, burglary.
Like
theft.
Theft or something like that. I would say if he had mentioned a specific crime, especially one, well, I'll go and say a crime of violence or something like that, then it would be very easy, oh, you're talking about my conviction, and cut the rest of that out. You're talking about my conviction.
And if that had happened as many times as his reference to being on probation or VOP did, it wouldn't have been logistically difficult to cut it out.
Logistics played no role in this whatsoever.
All right.
Now, again, that's another. The judge never said, he opened the door. Judge, we never said, oh, no, it's impossible to go through here and chop these out. No, it wouldn't be impossible. Difficult, but not impossible. No, you could do it, but you'd be left with some kind of jumble, and you'd also be left with a skewed view of what this interrogation was all about, right, from his point of view. And we wanted the jury to see as accurate a portrayal of this fellow when he was initially faced with this very serious accusation. But that is going to be important eventually in weighing who this fellow is and what he actually did and what he should be held responsible for.
If I understand your last comment, would it be fair to construe it as saying once you took out all the references to VOP or I on probation or words to that effect, you're left with nothing that would help the jury decide the case one way or another?
Well, you're left with, I have not gone through here and seen what it would look like.
Well, you're left with nothing but a denial that he committed
the crime.
It would be a
denial, basically. I don't know what you're talking about.
And the state wouldn't have wanted to introduce his statement if there was nothing in it for them.
Right. I would say that, certainly. Just a stray, I don't know what you're talking about. Well, that doesn't do us any good. We thought that, it was our position, and I think the trial judge agreed with us, that the taunting, I think that was the trial judge's words, this taunting attitude of his was relevant to the jury's final decision-making process. My friend has not had a chance to address the second issue, so I don't feel I should either. If the court has no further questions about either of these issues.
The only other question I have is I ask your colleague about the possession of a weapon while being a person prohibited and what that might have suggested to the jury in any event about his status as someone who's been convicted in the past or someone who's on probation. Does that have any effect, do you think, in the trial?
It was mentioned, my impression was he was prohibited because of his age, and that was pretty clear. So that's the only reason why a person prohibited would actually be tried rather than severed out, because they normally are.
Well, but
I could be wrong.
Perhaps it's just a point in my mind alone, but what is a jury going to think if they're left to speculate about why he's prohibited? Are they sophisticated enough to know that he's prohibited because he's 16, or are they going to believe he's prohibited because he's used a gun in the past, or do they have in their own mind some list of earlier offenses that would qualify somebody to a layman as someone who should be prohibited? Were they just left to speculate about it?
I don't think so. That was simply stipulated to that he was prohibited because of his age. I don't think the jury was left in the dark about that.
Okay.
I could be wrong. I mean, this was, I tried to go, zip through here to find the trial judge's instructions there, but I was operating under the assumption that it was because of his age, and that's why the charge was kept here.
And the jury knew it.
And the jury would know that it's because of his age. There was no reason to keep that secret.
All right.
Thank you.
I don't think that Mr. Donovan brought up any point that you didn't have an opportunity to address. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I do not disagree, but I would ask the court's permission just to clarify. I believe that Mr. Donovan is incorrect.
On the last point?
On the last point.
All right, well, we'll check the record on that. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.